Pseudopod, episode 193, May 7th, 2010. This week's story, Bed of Scorpions by Silvia Moreno Garcia. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Silvia Moreno Garcia. Silvia publishes the Innsmouth Free Press and has had work in fantasy magazine Futurismic and Shimmer. Her first novel, a magic realist story set in revolutionary Mexico called Proper People, is being polished as we speak. This story takes place in 20th century Mexico and originally appeared in the Canadian anthology Tesseract's 13 in October 2009. Your narrator this week is the one woman who Nina Kimberly the Merciless fears, the mighty Christiana Ellis. So get comfy, make sure you check your shoes, because I have a story for you. And I promise you, it's true.
Bed of Scorpions by Silvia Moreno Garcia. The maid brushed the two scorpions off the bed and crushed them under the heavy heel of her shoe when they fell to the floor. "You have to check the bed every morning," the maid said. "Check your boots. They tend to get in there too. And give a good shake to your clothes. The dangerous scorpions are not the black ones. The pale ones are the ones you can miss if you're too hasty." Beatrice stared at the white sheets. "Have a good night." The maid closed the door, and Beatrice was alone. She approached the large bed in the center of the room very slowly. She peeked under the covers, afraid the maid had missed an arachnid. Beatrice went to sleep, fearing she would wake up to the sharp sting of the scorpion. Beatrice rose early and found Ramon in the dining room. He seemed happy and untroubled, picking at some eggs. A shaggy, ugly dog roamed around the table. It made her nervous.
"Good morning. You want some chocolate? I can recommend it. But stay away from the solids. The cook has no talent and..."
"I thought he'd be here this morning." Ramon shrugged and lifted his fork. A piece of egg fell to the ground and the dog gobbled it up. "It's rude."
"There's plenty of time to meet and greet."
"Well, of course, why should you care?"
"Beatrice, don't start with that. It'll spoil breakfast. Sit down."
"He didn't send an automobile like he promised, and the house is old and ugly and shabby, and there are scorpions in the beds."
"Fine," Ramon said, his hands falling on the table, making the cutlery rattle. "We'll get on the train and to hell with everything. We spent all that time and money for nothing. All those dresses and hats, and now we're back worse than when we started."
She didn't tell them that they were always worse off. They would swindle and cheat and steal, but money evaporated from their hands, and then it was time to start over again. Beatrice bit her lip and was silent.
"Come on, sit."
"I'm not hungry."
"Beatrice," he began.
She did not pause for his apology. In Mexico City, they had a little courtyard with pretty potted flowers, a fountain, and canaries in their cages. But that was long ago and far away. In Durango, there was nothing. Or rather, there was a sea of weeds growing as high as her knee all around the property and insects buzzing next to her ear. A dirt trail led her towards some trees in a makeshift family cemetery with small headstones. From there, she could get a good look at the two-story house, which seemed more unattractive in the morning light than the previous evening when they had arrived. This is not, she decided, a proper hacienda. Her childish fantasies had conjured a magnificent mansion at the height of fashion with Parisian furnishings and a handsome husband. She ought to have known better. Movement in the grass startled Beatrice. Looking closer, she saw a huge snake scurrying behind a tombstone. She rushed into the house and sat in her room all day long. She heard him slip under the covers, but she did not turn around, her eyes fixed on the wall.
"You're still angry?"
She felt his breath against her neck and did not move, her body coiled tight.
Come on, don't be mad. Don't you want to...
No.
Beatrice,
we are in his house.
And so what? I don't care.
No.
Ramon fell back with a heavy sigh. You are insufferable.
Leave me alone.
Beatrice, look at me.
I want to be alone.
She turned and stared at Ramon, but he only shrugged in the way he always did, dismissing her words. She'd found his constant shrugs charming when they were younger.
Come, kiss me, he said.
She did, then bit his lips so hard they bled. When he buried his face against the crook of her neck, Beatrice stared at the ceiling and wondered if scorpions would fall upon them, like the maid said they sometimes did. She thought they might blanket their bodies during the night, and when dawn arrived, they would be dead. But in the morning, she still lived, and Ramon was gone. The next day, they ate mole, and the chicken was dry and unsavory. After the meal, the maid said that Mr. Villanueva was still sick and would not come downstairs. As a result, Ramon and Beatrice sat in the lounge by themselves and whispered to each other.
He'll be dead in 6 months, Ramon muttered.
You think so?
I hope so. He's thin as a stick. At least he was when I met him at the Victoria. He never got up before noon. And when he did, he was cold or burning hot all the time, and his hands shook.
But it's not contagious.
I told you no. Something in his blood.
But what if...
It's fine. Don't worry. Go around the house and see if there's any interesting stuff.
She did worry. She was supposed to marry that sick man. But Ramon had concluded their conversation. He unfolded the same paper he had carried under his arm during the train ride and pretended to read it. Beatrice left the lounge. She wandered through the hallways, noticing cracks on the checkered azulejos. Finally, she slipped into what the maid described as the library. It was disappointingly small. She didn't see any interesting stuff, which meant anything worth pocketing. If Villanueva proved to be more difficult than Ramon had anticipated, they could steal some items to justify their trip. She glanced at the paintings on the walls, her hands brushing the spines of the books. They had a great library once. In a corner, there had been a large terrestrial globe, and Ramon and Beatrice used to spin it and giggle, and their fingers would fall randomly over the places in the world that they would visit. But their father had been a gambler and a fool, and now they would never go anywhere. She turned away from the books. Something on a desk caught her eye. It was some type of mechanical bird. It had glass wings and bright glass eyes and sat in a golden cage. When she wound it up, it began to sing, moving its tail and beak. The bird turned its head, stared at Beatrice, and fell silent. The melody had concluded.
Do you like it?
She turned, knowing it must be him. The groom Ramon had picked for her. Some naive fellow to marry and cheat. He had black hair, dark eyes, and a plain face. He was younger than she had expected. Very young. Perhaps 20 to her 18 years.
It's extremely pretty, she replied.
It belonged to my mother. It sings 25 different melodies.
He walked towards her, leaning on a black cane and limping slightly.
I'm Justiniano Villanueva.
The limp, like his age, was a surprise. Her brother had said her groom was a fine gentleman, but he had not mentioned much else. Neither Villanueva nor his clothes looked very fine, though. Still, she smiled. She changed into the blue dress with the floral accents and the mother-of-pearl buttons, the nicest and newest one she had. The seamstress had assured her it was the style they were wearing in France. If she married Villanueva, Ramon had promised her, they would go to France, and there she would be a great lady in silks and diamonds. For now, France was a vague dream, far from the ugly little house and its shabby lounge where they congregated. Villanueva's mongrel dog sat by his feet, and the clockwork bird, now dusted for them to admire, played a short melody.
I'm sorry I couldn't come down earlier. I was indisposed.
We understand.
Beatrice sat quietly as they spoke. She wondered what Ramon might have told Villanueva when they first met. She tried to picture him speaking his business talk, all fake deals and imaginary tales, and then in the midst of it leaning forward and saying, very casually, of course, how he happened to have a sister.
How do you like it? I know it's not as grand as the Victoria.
I find it charming.
A beautiful sister who played the piano very well. A sister of marriageable age. Then some other bits of conversation, all steering him in the right direction. Their father had died recently. Beatrice was very sad, and Ramon worried that his business kept him away from Beatrice. She was all alone in that big house. And Villanueva probably leaned forward and wondered if both of them might not like to pay him a visit during the summer.
Well, hopefully you're not too bored. It's a quiet house.
We enjoy quiet, don't we?
A trap, of course, calculated. They had played that game before, but it had been the opposite way around. It was Ramon who married or promised marriage. Yes, Beatrice said, monosyllables the only form of communication she could manage at the moment. The bird stopped playing the melody, and Villanueva did not wind it up again. Later, hidden in the sea of grass, Ramon and Beatrice sat together. "Do you remember all those years I spent learning how to play the piano?" she asked. "Father said I simply had to learn that. Look now, there's no piano." She pulled bits of grass and let them fall onto the ground. "It scares me," she said finally.
"What?"
"That he's dying."
"Who cares?"
She turned to look at him.
"He's filthy rich, you know," Ramon said as he smoked a cigarette. Normally he wore gloves to avoid staining his fingers, but he had foregone such formalities in this remote corner of the state.
"I don't want to marry him."
"I said he was rich."
"Maybe he will not want to marry me."
"He better. And you'd better please him. There's more money here than we've ever had."
"Then you please him."
Ramon grabbed her by the jaw, fingers digging into her flesh, and pulled her forward. "I've had my share of old, ugly bitches in my bed. Sores and wrinkles and gray hair, all to keep you fed and dressed."
"To keep us fed and dressed," she muttered.
He squeezed her tighter and clenched the cigarette between his teeth. "Don't be an ungrateful little whore. You know what happens to ungrateful whores."
She blinked. She knew. "If you bruise me, he'll notice," she whispered.
Ramon removed his hand. "It's your turn this time," he muttered.
He thrust his hands into his pockets, hurrying back towards the house. It was difficult to walk with her fine blue dress and her nice shoes, but Beatrice picked up the edge of her skirt and ran behind him. "Don't try to come into my room again," she said. "I don't want you to ever come back again."
She tripped and fell, but he did not stop. She lay in the middle of the narrow dirt road. The fine new dress was now smudged and dusty.
She sat next to a dry fountain and did not turn when she heard Ramon approaching. But then the great ugly dog appeared at her side, wagging its tail, and she knew it was not Ramon standing behind her.
"Dinner's in an hour," Villanueva said.
Thank you.
That was all. She did not offer him any polite conversation. Perhaps her silence would inspire him to leave. He stayed, leaning on his cane as the sun set. She saw then, or perhaps noticed for the first time, a scorpion a few inches from her foot.
Oh my God, Beatrice said.
He also saw it, and sweeping down, grabbed the scorpion by the tail and held it up.
Oh my God, get rid of it, she yelled.
So he did, tossing it away, and she rushed inside the house. Justiniano joined her at a more leisurely pace.
How could you do that? She asked.
I've been catching scorpions since I was a child. I used to collect them.
You did?
I still have a few specimens lying around.
That's very odd.
Not in Durango.
I think it's disgusting, she said.
Justiniano shrugged, and she frowned, biting her lip.
So, how do you grab one without letting it sting you?
She looked at a jar filled with alcohol and tiny baby scorpions floating in it. There was also a wooden frame with several specimens carefully pinned and displayed on black velvet.
How can you collect them? How can you bear to touch them?
You shouldn't be afraid of them. Careful, but not afraid. I had a big black one sting me when I was a boy, but I'm not scared.
If a scorpion had stung me, I would never get near one again.
Do you want to hear an interesting story?
She closed the armoire that contained his specimens and books and sat in one of the rattan chairs across from him. His cane was propped against the wall. The dog lay at his feet.
A long time ago, a man was taking a stroll when he suddenly saw a white scorpion. He prepared to kill it, but then the scorpion yelled to the man, spare me, said the scorpion. I must kill you, said the man. Let us make a trade, cried the scorpion. The scorpion asked the man to take him to his home and let him live there upon a cushion of red velvet and feed him insects. If he did this, the scorpion said, he would be very lucky and gain much wealth. So the man did this, and the man became wealthy and well known. The scorpion, in turn, grew big and fat. He grew so big the man began to distrust it. Why, that scorpion is nearly the size of a cat, the man thought. If it ever got angry, it could sting me and kill me. Maybe I should kill it first. So the man fed the scorpion its daily ration of insects on a poisoned dish. Immediately the scorpion realized it had been betrayed. I am dying, but I will not die alone. You poisoned me, and I shall poison you. Let my poison live in your blood and claim the sons of your body. Let them all live short, painful lives. And then the scorpion stung the man and died. Since then, all the sons of the man have died young, but they have been immune to the venom of scorpions because they already carry the venom in their body. That is why I am never afraid of scorpions.
It was getting dark outside, and the library grew thick with shadows. The mechanical bird sitting on the desk reflected the sun's dying rays. Beatrice leaned back.
You really think I'm going to believe that story?
Would you believe when scorpions mate, they perform a dance?
No,
she said, chuckling.
And sometimes they devour each other.
As they dance? Why would they do that?
She asked with a smile.
I suppose it is in their nature.
The days passed, and then the weeks, and Ramon grew anxious. They had been invited to spend the summer there, and now the summer was coming to an end. Beatrice used to think of Paris often,
but now it was a blurry dream, and the thoughts of wealth and marriage had also faded. All that remained around her was the stolid reality of the small house, the fields kissing the orange sky, and Justiniano's slow steps at her side.
"When you're alone, what do you do?"
Ramona asked, pacing around the lounge. Beatrice rode with Justiniano beyond the cemetery, so far that the house disappeared, and farther still with the ugly dog by their side. Afterwards, they sat in the library, and she made the mechanical bird play its melodies. Beatrice shrugged and did not answer.
"Has he touched you?"
Ramon asked, his nails running down her left arm.
"He is not."
"He should. If he had you, then maybe he would feel obliged to marry you."
Beatrice shrugged again and caressed the head of the great dog, which sat at her side in the lounge.
"Maybe he does not care for marriage, and it would not matter if you dangled me naked in front of him. Have you thought of that?"
Ramon leaned forward, meaning to strike her. She recoiled. The dog growled, and Ramon stopped, his arm frozen in midair. He stepped back, staring at her in silence, and then went towards the door.
"Make it happen," he warned her. "You must make it happen."
Ramon was good with women. He could lie effortlessly to them. He had swindled half a dozen widows with a few words, a few smiles, and his youthful charm. Marriages happened quickly for him. 3-4 weeks of courtship, and they were before the priest, and just as quickly, Ramon and Beatrice had disappeared, taking with them jewels, money, anything they could. It was the easiest way to make money, he said, easier than fake business deals or some of his other shady endeavors. But what was simple for Ramon became complicated for Beatrice, because she liked Justiniano, because he was a nice man, open and kind, unlike them. They were the deceivers, the scorpions lurking between the bedsheets. So she sat in the library while the mechanical bird sang, and Justiniano read his book, and her fingers fell upon the chair's arm, marking the melody. She did not dare to speak, afraid some untruths might curl around her tongue. She was of the lineage of betrayers and thieves, both she and Ramon, shameless liars since birth.
"Why do you like the bird so much?" he asked.
Sometimes he asked her things like that, questions springing like water from his mouth, facts, tidbits of information about scorpions, butterflies, dogs, horses, escaped him all of a sudden for no reason. He talked suddenly of the animals he adored, and then of a story he had heard as a child, turning next to a poem in a book he had been reading. She did not mind. She'd grown accustomed to this, just as she had grown used to the great dog that always followed him, or that sometimes he had to pause for air when they were walking, like an old man, even though he was young.
"It's beautiful," she said.
"I think you should have it," he said.
"It was your mother's."
"No, it is yours."
He looked at her, his face happy and ablaze with a question.
"Thank you," she said.
She felt the lies welling inside her, and excused herself before he could speak. The next morning, Justiniano did not come out of his room, and she heard the maids whispering that he was ill again. The doctor arrived. The house was very quiet. Everybody crept around, talking in low voices, and Beatrice realized as the days bled into one another that they were all awaiting Justiniano's death. She locked herself in her room. The mechanical bird played its songs. Sitting in the middle of the bed, she could not think or speak or move. She only listened to the bird. Ramon sneaked in late one night and sat next to her.
"It's all ruined," he said. "He'll He'll be dead in a few days. That's what the doctor says.
She did not reply.
It's your fault. You would have been easy to handle. You mucked it up. Now what'll we do?
What we always do, she whispered.
What I always do. You are useless.
He headed towards the vanity and looked at the mechanical bird. The songs had all become the same, and she had not wound it up.
We'll sell this, and some other things. I've taken a few items. We'll go back to...
You can't sell the bird.
It's got to be worth something.
But it's mine. He gave it to me.
Ramon turned towards her and slapped her face. You'll do as I say.
No.
Come here, he said, and pushed her against the bed.
No, she said.
But she knew this melody. She'd danced this dance before. She did not rouse the house with her screams. This was who they were and what they were, entwined in anger and desperation and pain. Promenade à deux, Ramon and Beatrice. This dance had no beginning and no end. She awoke before dawn. The room was dark and quiet. Ramon had left. He always left before morning broke. Beatrice rose and combed her hair. She dressed slowly, pulling each button with care. Then she grabbed one of her shoes and looked at it as she did every day. That morning, a blinding white scorpion nestled inside one shoe. Rather than crushing it, rather than yelling and breaking it into 1,000 pieces, she whispered to the scorpion.
Let us make a trade.
She shook the shoe, and the scorpion fell to the floor. From the floor, it crawled onto her flattened hand. It sat there, as docile as a kitten. Beatrice went to Ramon's room. The curtains were pulled tight, shielding him from the sun's harsh glare. He lay under the blankets, smelling of salves and sweat.
It's just a fever, she said.
Beatrice, my chest hurts.
Hush.
I can't get up.
Ramon's skin was waxy, and his lips were chapped, as though he had been out in the sun for many hours, but he had spent the whole morning in bed.
You aren't going to leave me, are you?
He asked, trying to hold her hands.
You're going to sit here and stay with me until I get better.
Beatrice did not reply, but only smiled.
Bita.
He had not called her that in years, not since she was 8. She remembered a studio, a portrait of the children. While the photographer fiddled with the camera, their father had said they must remain still. She held her breath and clutched Ramon. It seemed to her that a decade after she still remained in the same pose, a little girl in her prim dress, motionless against a theatrical backdrop.
Bita, answer me,
he demanded, his nails digging against her skin. But the nails were brittle and tore like silk paper. Beatrice unlaced her hands from his. Beatrice changed her clothes for dinner, molting into a bright yellow gown Ramon had disliked. On the vanity, the mechanical bird sang a tune she had not heard before. As she swept her hair up, she heard a knock at the door. Justiniano stood there, a flimsy phantom suddenly made solid. He looked tired, with dark circles under his eyes, but he did not carry his cane, and Beatrice knew very soon he would be fine. Perfectly fine.
How do you feel? She asked.
Better,
he replied, but there were questions in his eyes. She touched his face, straightened, and kissed him, brushing away his questions with her hands.
A I've been on a bit of a Rolling Stones kick recently, and by recently I mean probably the last 7 to 14 years. And the classic era Stones, the really solid, tight, dark rock band stuff, that's written into my DNA the same way Doctor Who is, the same way Day of the Triffids is, the same way the first three bars of The Healer by John Lee Hooker are the opening credits of the greatest cop show I will never make. You can't always get what you want is one of the ones I keep coming back to, and it's what this story put me in mind of. It's incredibly easy to slip into a double bind and not even notice, to find yourself in a situation where if you go forward, you get stung, and if you go backward, you get stung. And if you don't go anywhere, you get stung. So what on earth do you do, besides make a deal with a scorpion, and Sylvia presents that perfectly by not presenting it at all? Less is more is always interesting, and I love how she uses that approach here. If you don't have that as an option, your only other option is to break the situation before it breaks you. Break things to fix things, and know in doing so, it'll be so much worse for a while. There is no harder step than that first one, that realization that things can and should be better for you, that you deserve to be happier. We are conditioned as a species to accept our lot, to assume things are meant to be as they are, but if that was the case, you would be listening to this on a stone iPod the size of a house as you jogged around your cave, chasing down the last mammoth. Our stone iPods would be cool. So, don't accept your lot, don't stand by, don't go gentle into the good night, change something, take control, see what happens. Prepare to be surprised. By me asking you for money, amongst other things. Okay, it's not a surprise, but it is necessary as we rely on you to pay our authors and cover our costs. So if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you won't regret it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Join us next week as Lee Thompson teaches us how to crawl and we find out what happens when we do. Until then, Pseudopod knows society wants you all to remember, don't be too black, don't be too gay, just get a little duller. And Pseudopod knows society is wrong.